Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Uh-oh, because there's an airplane out there.
Yeah, that's right, and everybody's boarding. Let's go.
Airline travel's very dangerous.
But don't be silly. It's the safest travel in the world. You're going to love this. Trust me.
Yeah.
Now, come on.
Oh, no.
Ray.
Yeah?
We're in an airport. People fly out of airports. What do you think we were doing here this whole time?
Yeah, flying's very dangerous. 1987, there were 30 airline accidents. 211 were fatalities. And 231 were definite passengers.
Yeah, well, this plane is very safe, believe me. What, is it
know.
This airline?
Yeah.
Is it this airline?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. We can, there's an American plane.
American Flight 625 crashed April 27th, 1976.
We don't have to take American. There's a lot of flights.
Yeah, take another airline.
Now, there's a Delta.
Yeah.
God, I mean, it leaves at midnight, Ray, you know, but Delta, how's Delta?
The Delta crashed August 2nd, 1985, Lockheed L-1011. Dallas-Fort Worth.
Right.
Terrible wind.
All airlines.
135.
All passengers. All airlines have crashed at one time or another. That doesn't mean that they are not safe.
Qantas.
Qantas?
Qantas never crashed.
Qantas?
Never crashed.
Well, that's...
Never crashed.
I mean, that's going to do me a lot of good, Ray.
Yeah.
You see, Qantas doesn't fly to L.A. out of Cincinnati. You have got to get to Melbourne.
Australia.
Melbourne, Australia, in order to get the plane that flies to Los Angeles. Do you hear me?
Canberra's a capital. 16.2 million population.
We're not going to take the plane. He's okay. He's okay.
Yeah.
He's okay. We're not going to take the plane. Just relax. He was upset. We were going to take the plane. We're not going to take the plane now. We're not going to take the plane, Ray. We're not going to fly, okay?
No flying.
Rain Man, you know that movie? It's a classic, and the reason I call it a classic is because it's taken its template from Shakespeare, who actually stole it from the Bible, as a way of communicating a person that's soon to change. Two characters there, the Tom Cruise character and Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman character, are in for quite a wild ride together. I'm telling you this more than to just acknowledge there is a movie there, but it's going to be a homework assignment for you as you apply it to some passages. So you need to look at those two characters as they introduce themselves as one person thinking there's many ways from Cincinnati to Los Angeles and one realizing there's only one way. One person... kind of knows himself. The other person thinks he knows himself. One person knows his limitations and is content with those limitations and is at peace. The other person thinks he can do anything. And we'll find out that he can't and it will crash his life. One person is an idiot savant. The other one is just an idiot. And it's set in the context of travel, a person going someplace they haven't been before, and the journey itself will be a journey not of miles, that will be true, but of the soul. It's a classic story. Again, you see a lot of writers use this, and they stole it from the Bible. Some of the best stories ever told, in the way they tell the stories, are found in the Bible. And in these journeys of people's lives, they find out who they are, who they're not. And then they have to face God with that. In our series together called Unstuck, we're in it 6 weeks, and we spent the first 2 weeks talking about the wall and the stages of faith and that sort of thing. And then now this week and next week, we're going to talk about knowing ourselves so we can know God better. Classic Augustine quote that to know God, we have to first know ourselves. And so I wanted you to see that clip from Rain Man to apply it to a passage of Scripture. We can read this throughout this week from Genesis 25 to 29. That's the story of Jacob. And I want you to ask yourself the questions. What is the journey that he's on? Who is being changed? And how is he being changed? Most importantly, I want you to apply that to your own life. And literally, when were you on a journey? We tend to be strengthened in community and tested in isolation. That is the case in this movie, Rain Man. It is the case in Jacob's life. It's the case in our lives most of the time. When you went off to college or when you moved to Austin or when you were on a trip. You were on a trip. And we want you to start this week thinking about how you are fearfully and wonderfully made, how God knows all about you, and how that unique design gives you a unique way of knowing God, a unique path of knowing God. And then figure out how that path might be maybe filled with traps, temptations, bents in your direction towards destruction, right? And then what you're going to do about that. Okay, that's just a feeder for next week. This lets you know a little bit about what we'll be talking about. It'll help you get insight into the life of Jacob when we look at that. This week, I want to tell you a little about knowing yourself. We'll look at the life of David. Since last week we talked about David's life, I'd like to follow that up with a kind of a second part of his life. But before you do, I want you to kind of maybe keep the mindset of coaching, if you would, in the way we look at David. I had a friend that was at the University of Texas, was one of the football players there, and we spent some time together. He was a very interesting individual, and I learned a lot about the coaching of college students from his experience at the university, because he, one of the star players, one of his friends, was from kind of a pretty bad background, pretty neglected, let's just put it that way. He's neglected. He never, this athlete, never mentioned his father or mother. I mean, never. He had four brothers, and it was as though the five of them just raised each other. No boundaries, no limits. And because he was a star athlete, he had celebrity status. He was much bigger than other people in his age group, and he was a great athlete. And so he was treated as an adult even in junior high. And so girls were pursuing him at an early age, and that did not go well for him, for his soul's sake. And then adult men, because they wanted to be around what they knew would be a great athlete someday, they were buying him beer and taking him places that he should have never gone. His loss of innocence at such an early age kind of torqued him and made him pretty reckless. He was a very passionate individual. He's impulsive, and he would go anywhere and do anything, and you never knew what he was going to say, or was really scary, is you never knew what he was going to do next. Well, he was such a vital part of the team. I thought it was very interesting in how the coaches dealt with him, because to win in college football, at least college football, it seems like you have to make the very best of your players. You have to be able to out-strategize, you know, the opposing teams. But there's a nurturing, a soul care of the players themselves that's paternal and maybe sometimes even maternal. And you just have to care. They're young men. And so what they did with this young man is they moved him off campus and had him live with a Catholic priest in South Austin. True story. He's living in South Austin, far from campus and far from the hustle and bustle and the celebrity status and people looking at him and gawking at him and living in the athletic dorm there. And he lived with this Catholic priest that brought about great structure to his life. You know, he woke up at the same time. He ate at the same time. He exercised. Enormous amount of discipline. And then when they, besides having him live his about 3 years there at the priest's place, when they go on away games, I mean, you could imagine what the coaches did about where they put his locker, right? They put his locker next to two other young men who had very stable lives. His roommate during away games was a very grounded individual, not that good of an athlete, but a very grounded individual. He had a great upbringing. He understood discipline, and he was usually the first one to bed every time they ever were away. And so they linked these two guys together for the sake of his soul so that he would be a better player so that the team could win, and they did because of that care. The point is that the coach knew that boy, and he knew him probably better than he knew himself. And because of that, he was able to make the very best out of his life. They were able to protect him and shelter him and deliver him from temptation. Do you know that about yourself? Do you know that about how God made you and maybe the experiences that you've had growing up? Now, this person was brought to my mind because I was looking at the passages this week, and I thought, boy, this person seems to me a lot like King David. King David was a very passionate person. I mean, you need to look at his life as though he is an extremely emotional individual. And if you look at it In 1 Samuel chapter 25, there's a cute little story there where he is and his 600 men are you basically being the protection for a gentleman farmer who a rancher that had many sheep. His name is Nabal, and Nabal means fool in the Bible. I mean, that's his nickname, is Nabal, and he's a foolish man. And so David and his 600 troops are making sure that no one is stealing his sheep and making sure his shepherds are well cared for and are safe and that sort of thing. And then so it's sheep shearing season, and it's time to slaughter a couple of sheep. And David has a couple of his men go and say, hey, you know, since we've been, you know, providing protective custody for you guys, we'd love to get in on your festival. And Nabal says, who is David? I mean, he's just like a renegade running away from Saul. Why would I care about him? Well, these two men come back to David, and here's David's passionate response. One sentence, put on your swords. Put on your swords. 600 men, I'll leave 200 here, 400 of you mount up. And here's what he said. Here's a quote. Okay, and he says, may God deal with David ever so severely if I leave one man alive tomorrow morning. Wow. The punishment doesn't seem to fit the crime on that one, does it? All those innocent shepherds and house workers and just individual men that were the guys in charge of digging wells. David will kill them all. May God be severe to me. Well, fortunately, Nabal's wife headed that off. But I just wanted you to just hear that David was a passionate person. Don't make him mad. Okay? All right, you don't want to get your swords. And then, this is not a criticism. I mean, it's just it's a statement of observation. When the Ark was coming into Jerusalem, a very famous scene, probably vivid in your mind as well, in 2 Samuel chapter 6, it's the first time the Ark makes it to a capital city, the city of David, Jerusalem, and David is in out front in nothing more than an ephod, a pair of underwear. And he is dancing, it says, with all of his might, it says, he was dancing with all of his might in front of the Ark. And that's not the way kings behave, but he is a very passionate king. And I'm not saying anything's wrong with it. I'm just making an observation that this person is very emotional. And it's not a bad thing here. I'm not going to make fun of him. Someone did, and they got cursed for it. Don't get me wrong at all. What I'm saying is that he's a passionate worshiper. You better, like, stand clear when he's worshiping. You know, we have some worshipers like that where you got to give him a seat or two on each side, you know. It's not. I'm just making a statement of the way he's made. And I mean, he's a poet. He's a poet writer. He's a very creative person. So many of the Psalms are attributed to him because he's, again, I mean, he's just that way. It's the way God made him. My point is, it's the way God made him, and thank God for that. I mean, don't you love poets and artists? They can express things that we can't, and we, you know, it's why we buy Hallmark cards. Yeah. That's what I meant to say, honey. I love you. So my point is that David is supposed to know that about himself. He's going to be trapped in predictable places of being trapped by a person who is a passionate person. And if you were to coach David, what would you tell him about a person with great passion? Where would he be weak and vulnerable and exposed, as opposed to a person who is greatly disciplined or a perfectionist, that sort of person? This showed up on the internet this week. I don't know if you saw it, but there's this guy going, why would a fly land on something that looks like that? This is kind of goofy. He says, I'd be embarrassed if, what does it say? I should be ashamed of getting caught in something like that. And then he says, oh, come on, bears. How could you possibly let yourself get stuck in this? And then the fourth frame was this. I think he's on Pinterest. He's done. We laugh because, you know, we can say a stupid fly would fall into that trap, and a mouse would fall into that trap, and a bear would fall into that trap, and then we find ourselves in a trap. What I want to to do today is I want to look at the life of David and his great failure, and I want us to see that if David were more aware of himself and the way that he was made and the way that he was raised and his experiences in life, that he didn't have to do what he did. Now, I want you to listen to the background music. Whenever you read the Old Testament narratives, it's very important to think of it cinematically. And what's most important when you're reading is listening for this background music of setting the tone of whether this is a happy time or a bad time or a daring time or whatever it might be. And in the background music in Bible writing back then, especially in these great stories that I mentioned Shakespeare would learn from, is repetition of words and especially repetition of phrases or comments by the narrator. In other words, when people are speaking in quotes, that's a good thing. But when the narrator says something, we want to exaggerate it. We want to make it a booming voice because that person's telling us the mood or the music in the background that's giving us clues to what's happening, and our emotions should be attached to that. Okay? Well, the story is actually from 2 Samuel from chapters 10 to 12. It's three chapters in there. And the word that's going to be repeated over and over again 23 times is the word sent or send. And the reason it's a common word, you'd think it'd be used a lot. But the reason it's emphasized here is because the king of Israel, David, shouldn't be sending. He should be going. He shouldn't be delegating. He should be doing. And that's where he gets in trouble. His whole career has been a man of action, and now he's going to switch to a man of leisure. And this writer is trying to help us understand that mood and to be warned by it, you know, kind of the jaws, dun, 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 by keep using this word send. Okay? So in the first part of the story, it's the typical part of 2 Samuel chapter 10. This is the way it should be. A king dies, his son takes over, David sends flowers basically and says, "Hey, how can I help you guys? I would love to make peace." And the man shames his messenger, this new king. The prince becomes king and shames his messenger, and David does what David does. Get your swords. And he starts this big war, and the point of chapter 10 is it's the way it should be. In the course of time, the king of the Ammonites died, and his son Hanan came over as king. And after he embarrassed him, David's men, David and all of his men gathered in Israel, and they crossed the Jordan River, and they went after him. And they fled before Israel and David, and they killed 700 of their charioteers and 40,000 of their foot soldiers, and they struck him down, the commander of their army, and there he died. Man, that's great. And then things change in chapter 11. A trap. That's when things, the mood changes, because we start sending and we start going places that we shouldn't be. Look how the narrator explains this in just his setting up of the scene. And in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole, or some translations say, all of the Israelite armies. What happens in the spring? Who goes to war? Kings do. It says when kings go out to war. It's still that way in Afghanistan. In the spring, when kings go out to war, that's the war season. And it says here that David doesn't go. He sends Joab, that's his commander-in-chief, and all the king's men and the whole Israelite army. It says all of them. Now, if you can picture in Jerusalem, David stays back in Jerusalem because he's not going to go back and finish this war that he's involved in. That if you could visualize Jerusalem, inside the walls, there are very old men that are feeble. There are young boys playing, and there are no able-bodied men in the entire town, less one. And there are a lot of beautiful women, unattended by their husbands, because David sent them to war because it's spring, and everybody goes to war in the spring. So the next verse says, it's the next sentence, the same verse. And this they destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in the city. This is what everyone else is doing. This is what men do in the spring. Look at the attack. They destroy and they besiege. And David remains. And what was he doing? He was killing time. He was playing with mouse traps and fly traps and bear traps and king traps. The point is, I'm trying to make here is that the author is showing that he should never have been there, and he's doing this by saying the word sent, and he's doing this by saying how many, just describing what ought to be happening, not what is happening. And so the adultery takes place in the next verse, and it's odd that the next verse says this: "And in the evening, when David got up from his bed and walked around the roof of the palace." What were the last descriptive words used in the previous verse? Besieging, right? Everybody else is in combat, and I bet they sleep pretty well at night because they're sleeping on the ground and they've had a pretty rough day of besieging and sieging. David, meanwhile, is in his bed restless, because that's what happens when you're in the wrong place and you have too much time. And so he goes out on his rooftop and he sees what he says is a very beautiful woman, and he sends for her. And his servant says, well, she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. She's the daughter of a pretty important family. And so he sends for her. Uriah, there's a list at the end of 2 Chronicles or 1 Chronicles of the men who win what would be the Medal of Honor. And Uriah is on that list. That's the kind of soldier he is. And David says, but she's beautiful in my eyes. And then he lays with her and sends her out, and then she sends him word that she's pregnant, and then he has to move to the next stage, and that's the cover-up. And so what does he do again? In one verse or two verses, sent is used three times, and David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite, and Joab sent him to David. And so David has got to figure out a way to get Uriah in bed with his wife Bathsheba so it'll look like the pregnancy is theirs, you see. And so he brings Uriah in off the field to just get a report. And then it's interesting. He sends, there's the quote, and he says, go to your house now. You've been on such a long journey. Go and wash your feet. And so Uriah left the palace and a gift from the king that he sent after him. Here's some flowers and some chocolates for your wife. And you know, have a great night. And Uriah sleeps on his front porch. And there's a reason, because the author is again trying to tell you through this background music, through this expression of the description of the story, that David should never have been here in the first place. And Uriah, in his action, is going to contrast the loss of insight and character of David. And so Uriah said to David, he says, why'd you sleep on your porch? And Uriah says this: well, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and the Lord's men are camping in open fields. How could I go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I could never do such a thing. I mean, look, everybody is camping out in this field at this battle. I mean, there's Israel and Judah and the general Joab, and I mean, for goodness sake, the Ark of the Covenant's living in a tent. I mean, no one's living at home. Yeah, right. But you. Uriah the Hittite, they keep calling him that because he's from outside Israel. He's not one of the 12 tribes. He's a convert to Israel, to Judaism, to a follower of Jehovah. This outsider who's a follower of Jehovah is put in contrast with the king of Israel, a man after God's own heart. That's what the author's saying. So look, it gets worse. So David figures he's got his hands full with him. So he says, okay, look, I'll tell you what. Before you go back to battle, why don't you spend one more night with me? Let's talk. Let's tell war stories, shall we? And he just keeps feeding him wine. David does. Gets him hammered, drunk. Sends him home. Surely now, with the alcohol, he'll be impassioned to have passion with his wife. And he doesn't. The author is saying a drunk outside Uriah the Hittite is a better man of character and knows where he should be, as opposed to a righteous, sober king who is no longer righteous. Uriah knows himself and knows what he's made to do, and he will do that. And David is playing around in traps. So that's the music. David is in the point is David is in the wrong place. And he does the one last part of the story here is David does one more set of sending. He sends Uriah to his death. He literally writes the instructions on how to take Uriah out by putting him in the front of a siege and then back up without telling Uriah and have him killed by the bad guys. And that's how Uriah is killed. The point here is that what the author is making here, that's, I'm telling you the story this way because the author wants us to see that David was in the wrong place because David thought he could be anywhere and he couldn't. He was a passionate individual, and a passionate and creative people do not do well with lengthy leisure. And if you know people of that ilk, you know that, and hopefully they know that too. If you were to coach a person like David, wouldn't you say, hey, what are you doing? I mean, one of his best friends, David, look, you know what? You can go and take a rest to rest to come back, but you can't go and rest to rest because people like you don't rest well for too long. Idle Hands is the Devil's Workshop was written about men like you. If someone were coaching them, that's what they'd coach. How did it happen? When did it start? If David could get one of those fancy DeLoreans and go back in time, how far back do you think he'd go? You think he'd go to the part where he walks across the threshold of the gates of the city and say, ooh, this is where I went wrong. No, I think he would rewind it a lot more than that. I think he'd go back to one of the battles and say, gosh, I'd love to get home. And I'll just, you know, I could send everyone else out to battle. And then he'd double clutch and say, wait a minute. I'm a passionate person and I cannot go home when that city's empty of every man and filled with beautiful women. I got to go back there and stop myself because I know myself. I know wise people. I like looking at wise people because they know who they are and they're okay with the boundaries that they set. They're like Raymond who knows he can't fly and they live with that. When I was a little bitty kid, I have a very vivid, detailed, and expansive imagination. And my point is that you can watch movies I can't watch. It's not wrong for you to watch movies that I can't watch. I'm just saying I can't watch certain movies. Because when I lay in bed at night, and I don't mean when I was a kid, I meant last night, and I hear something outside, I don't think it's a bad guy that's out on parole or something. I think it's a large 6-7 foot insect that wants to come in my house because he's like from a space alien and wants to impregnate me with his spawn so that I might give birth to it later. That's what I fear at night. And so when you watch those scary space movies, I say, knock yourself out. And you can sleep, but I can't. So I'm just saying, a guy's got to know his limitations. So when I was with Walk Through the Bible Ministries, you know, we traveled all over the world, literally, and taught the Bible, and it attracted a pretty passionate group of people, and the organization was losing men to stupid decisions, and the decisions started when they walked in their hotel rooms. And so Bruce Wilkinson said, okay, new rule, here's how it works. You want to work for Walk Through the Bible, this is what you do. You walk in your hotel room, you unplug your TV set, and then you spin it around and face the wall. I'm not suggesting everyone that travels do that. I'm not suggesting everybody needs to do that. I'm just saying if you are if you're kind of an undisciplined, passionate person, it probably is not a bad idea. That's how Walkthrough kept their instructors safe. I know people that have an issue with greed. They're always hoarding. They always want more savings for later. Their future is always filled with anxiety. And so they have said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lock into a certain income amount that's a safe level to live on and to get and to save for the future, and I'm going to give everything else away because generosity is the cure for greed, and they know that. I'm not suggesting everybody does that. I'm just suggesting that's what's necessary for people that know themselves well. I had a friendly conversation with a gentleman that's a friend for 10 years. And he is the champion in his discipline. And I said, you know, it's interesting. I want to know that I caught you. I've been wanting to tell you this for years, but you never let people talk about your accomplishments for very long. How come you always deflect the conversation? And he said, he caught me. I said, what's that about? He said, I don't like being praised because I know what happens to people that like it. And I start to like it myself. It never goes well. I said, pride before fall? He goes, pride before fall. And so anytime people start talking about where he's been and what he's done, he just kind of go, well, isn't that interesting? And how about you? I know a woman who's a gossip and has a bent towards that, and she will not complain about anything, about any person, about anything. Now, this was an expensive decision for this particular woman because she lost all of her friends because birds of a feather, they flock together. And when she stopped gossiping and then couldn't be around gossip anymore, she had to find a group of people that were not of that way. You see, we're all so uniquely made, and that's what I want us to look at today. I want us to look at David's life and say, well, sure, I would coach David in a way that would protect him from evil. What about you? This is kind of the application observation. What is your trap? What does your trap look like? It's going to be different than my trap or the bait that's going to be used to the person next to you. And let me just state the obvious. Do you think the devil knows what your bait is? I think he does. So let's not talk about pride and ability to thwart certain things when those things are usually the things that destroy us the most. If you were to coach you, what would you protect yourself from? Who would you put as your roommate on an away game? If you're a perfectionist, probably a melancholy, would you room with somebody that's a melancholy perfectionist? I don't think that would turn out well. You can be mentored by someone that is of the same kind of likenesses that has learned, and you can learn from them, but you don't. Your peer group, if it's all like you, you guys could all be on a rooftop together when you're supposed to be out to war. So the first part of the application and your discussion questions were, you know, we're going through a book together. They're on sale again. Your homework, I think it says at the bottom, I think it's the apply chapter 4. Here's some of the questions. If you don't know how you were made, you might not know your final destination. You have to understand how you're made to understand your final destination. Your destination is different than someone else that's made differently, what God's going to do with your life. And you have to figure out the way you're made and be okay with that. I'm sure you've seen studies of twins separated at birth, you know, and they're raised by completely different people on different parts of the country with different economic backgrounds. And then they catch up with them and they're both 42-year-old men that drive 69 blue, you know, El Caminos. And they have a dog named Jeff that's a golden retriever. And it's just kind of freaky how their lives are so much the same and they've never talked. Or they didn't even know they had an identical twin. I'm not suggesting fatalism. I'm not suggesting that, you know, the way you're made determines everything. I'm just offering the obvious. Do you know how you're made? And are you okay with that? And then what are you going to do about that? That's part of our thing I want you to work on this week. So we'll look at it again next week. And then the second one, if you don't know how you've been raised, you might not know how you're going to get there. That's a kind of a different question, okay? It's not how you're made, but how you were raised. Some of the way that you were brought up, the memories that you have, and sometimes the bad memories that are haunting you, if you choose. I'm not fatalistic. I'm not suggesting it is the way you are. It causes the way that you are. I'm saying it is, here's the best part. It is the unique journey that you get to write a story about overcoming. Had a wonderful conversation with a man this week that has a crazy, crazy story of the way he was raised. And his story is about how the power of God's grace is overcoming all those crazies. He's not a victim of the way he was raised. He's a conqueror of the way he was raised. And his story is so unique. It's something to be made into a movie. I want you to be asking yourself these three questions when you're looking through the life of Jacob, when you look at those stories, and we're going to look at this again. But to know God, you have to know yourself. You have to understand yourself well. Last week we said, look, there's the homework, chapter 4, emotional healthy spirituality. We're calling it Unstuck because, well, for obvious reasons. It's out there in the lobby. If you could read chapter 4. Look, last week we said everybody's going to make our way across a desert. Your journey includes a desert. And to have a Bible and a compass as your compass, that's a good thing. To have a guide, that's a great thing. A mentor, someone 10 or 15 years older than you. We provide that here at our church. But here's something. Wouldn't you like one of these? A map? Wouldn't you like a map? If you come back next week, we'll give you a map. Not a map that fits everyone in this room, a map for you. A map that will take into account the way you were made, the way you learn, your probable snares and traps, what the bait will be to cause you to ruin. And we're going to try to help you understand yourself and the people next to you. And we're going to help get you guys into groups where you could share that with each other. And you could be a friend of David, Joab. Where was Joab? David, do not go home. We'll win this battle without you, but you'll go home and lose a battle that you'll never recover from. I know you, David. You're a man of passion. And that's going to get you killed. That's what we want to be. We want to be a group of people that know each other well enough to be able to say those sorts of things. All right, let's close our time in prayer and have a song of worship. I'll pray that same prayer again, Psalm 139. Oh Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know me when I sit down and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and lying down. And you're familiar with all of my ways. And before a word is even on my tongue, you know it completely. You hem me in from behind and before me, and you have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. You're too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? And God, like we prayed earlier, you know us so well. I'd ask that you would help us know ourselves. That we pray that you would deliver us from evil and you would deliver us from temptation. God, would you help us deliver ourselves from that temptation? Would you help us understand the story that you have for us, that we could write it and write it well? That we would be conquerors and not victims. That we would be a light for people in kind of our same way of making and background. We could kind of plow a path for them, a path that leads to freedom and to understanding and to victory. And that we would not be a life on the side of the road that's a carcass of a blown-up life for others to just look in and be warned by. Let us be a lighthouse to people, a beacon. We pray this in Jesus' holy name. Amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.